How many of us are hungover today?
How many of us are lying?
Yes. So, to start your morning off right, here's Tom Lane, whom I think all of you know by email, if not otherwise. Yeah.
I find it offensive that he's not wearing this t-shirt.
I wore it all day yesterday. What do you want?
Yeah.
We'll go get you another one.
Yep. And in addition to writing approximately 400,000 emails per day, that's just for the Postgres project. It doesn't include libjpg, right?
I haven't done anything on libjpg in a while.
Okay.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah. Tom also works for Red Hat, who are nice enough to let him stay home and send him checks so that he can work on Postgres. Bruce Momgen, my other fellow core team member, who works for EnterpriseDB, that great company who not only sponsored the conference but bought you all drinks last night so you could have so much trouble getting out of bed this morning. So they're going to tell you how to get your patch rejected from PostgreSQL with the minimum amount of pain.
Absolutely.
So take it away, guys.
All right.
First, I appreciate that Dan decided to like start us a little late today, but maybe it's not late enough, so maybe we need a little more later next. Because I know I didn't get in. I was the last person to leave, obviously, so it was a little hard getting up. Our talk is about how to get your Postgres patch accepted. Do you remember who suggested this talk idea?
I think we were just kicking things around and that came up.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those sort of epiphanies where you hear the talk topic and you're like, oh, why didn't we do this years ago? I mean, it's something that you have in your head and that you're working with all the time, and some knowledge that obviously we have in trying to move Postgres forward and keep it reliable at the same time, but we've never really written it down perhaps as clearly, I think, as we're going to do here.
Yeah. As befits the first thing in the morning talk after the party, there's not going to be a whole lot of technical detail here.
Exactly.
We are actually going to focus quite a bit on emotions and the way to approach things. And to help us with that, we've prepared some visual aids like that.
So, yeah, there's a lot of sort of visual jokes in this presentation. But as Tom said, the important thing, a lot of times we have a lot of these technical specifications of how to submit a patch in the developer's FAQ, but, you know, they don't come across sometimes, and we're continually having to re-implement them and sort of re-express what to do, and we're hoping that this patch is going to bring across those concepts in a more entertaining way and hopefully a way that is better communicating, because a lot of the things that we're talking about are not things that you deal with on a regular basis. A lot of the requirements of applying a patch or submitting a patch are different than your daily lives, and therefore you need to kind of accept that and understand what that is. Isn't that what you were saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So this slide is basically a representation of how you might approach a programming project or a repair project within your organization, okay? So, for example, if this was my home and I was going to repair some of the roof or the plumbing, or I was working in an IT organization and I needed to fix a script in a web page or some type of job, again, some organizations have... You're working in this type of environment, where everything's kind of bolted together. You just need to get the job done and move on to the next thing, okay? I mean, how many people work in organizations where sometimes it feels like this? Okay. I feel for you. I remember what it was like. The rest of you haven't raised your hands. I know you know. Okay. So it's perhaps not this bad, but you're used to having an approach to code where you need to sort of just get the job done as quickly as possible, move on to the next thing, and you don't have to worry too much about some of the more long-lasting aspects of your changes.
Now, I don't want to imply that there aren't parts of the Postgres code base that look like that, because there are some. But, you know, really where we're trying to get to is to renovate to something more like that. It's an old code base that we're working with. You know, the origins of it go back to mid-80s at Berkeley. And we are hoping, you know, that it's still around another 20 years from now and still useful. And to have a code base that will have that kind of longevity, we really have got to have very high standards. So, you know, we are basically working with something where you want to think not only will it get the job done today, but will it be maintainable down the road. Anything more to say about that?
That's great. So that's the first thing we want to get across is the understanding, and some people, I'm sure, bristle at it, that we're telling them that they have to build, you know, a Maserati when they think they're running, you know, a Hugo or one of those smart cars that I hate when I see. So the bottom line is that we are building a fairly long-running, established piece of code that's last a long time. So if we appear to be a pain when we say, you know, that variable name isn't good, and you're like, well, what's the problem, right? What's the problem? You know, it works, right? We're like, no, you don't understand. We're having to look at this type of system. And again, you benefit because we've been doing this for so long and we've been targeting this type of system. The second aspect that we wanted to get across was to start simple, okay? I don't know how many of you, I'm sure everybody has just been to like a buffet, right? A food buffet. And there's pretty much two approaches to a food buffet. The one approach is basically to take a little bit of everything, go back to your table, try a bunch of stuff, and then go back and whatever you liked a lot, you kind of get some more of. The other approach is sort of just to get the biggest whatever and just load your plate up huge, right? The bottom line is that typically doesn't work too well. It also doesn't work too well in code. You might be attracted to a huge feature that you want to add to Postgres, but starting with that huge, huge feature is often going to lead to failure. Because while you're working on that huge feature, you've got to deal with all these other new things that are coming at you because you're working in a community. We're going to talk about some of those later in this talk. We already talked about one before. But the bottom line is that this is a new environment, probably for you, and you don't get tempted and take too much of a bite out of the feature. Start small, start simple, get success working in the community and experiencing what it's like to go through a patch process, to go through review in public. Don't start with a huge thing, because unfortunately many people who start with huge patches do not succeed and end up being rejected and dejected and often don't come back.
Right. The way I occasionally explain this is you've got to walk before you can run. We have seen a number of cases where somebody came in and, you know, with really no prior experience with the community, they wanted to implement some, you know, huge feature or other. And a few of them have succeeded. Most of those attempts have been failures. So we, you know, want to encourage people to go out. You know, if this is going to be your first patch, find something small to do. You know, do it, shepherd it through the process, get your feet wet, learn your way around the code in particular, and then you're going to be able to scale up and, you know, tackle something a little more complicated, and, you know, eventually get to the point where, you know, you can do this. but this is not the first patch you ought to be submitting. So.
Exactly. This is actually an AP photo. Yeah, this is an AP photo that was done about 6 months ago, and I saw it on the internet and downloaded it, and I said, someday this is going to be in the useful feature. And in fact, today was the day. So Yeah, start simple. You know, Tom brought up an interesting point where he's saying, get used to the code base, get used to kind of what it's like to do. I mean, again, we've had a couple people, he said, who've come, and you're like, where did that guy come from, right? I remember a bunch of cases where, like, where did that guy come from? And Jan was one of them when he just showed up with, you know, and I'm like, where did this guy come from? That he's come up with this huge, complete, working patch to Postgres that just revamps a whole subsystem. Odds, but the bottom line is we're surprised when that happens because it doesn't usually happen. Usually what happens is somebody kind of limps along, gives us something that's way beyond their capability, kind of struggling to sort of understand what it is and how to integrate it and what changes he needs to make. And it's such a big patch that they often get very frustrated. They've got to rewrite a whole huge amount of patch. And, I mean, I remember when Simon sort of took on point-in-time recovery and sort of ran at it, and then we had to really back up a long way, if anybody remembers, and take him back to the, and walk him back through the process again. And I remember talking to him on the telephone and thinking, he's going to leave. You know, I finally found somebody who's stupid enough to do point-in-time recovery, and I'm talking on the phone, and I'm like, I'm on the phone, and I'm trying to be firm that we need to do it this certain way, and unfortunately you haven't done it that way, and we're going to have to redo it. But I can feel his voice getting lower and fainter, and you know, unfortunately, he stuck with it. But again, that's not the ideal situation. Okay, we talked about some of the aspects of working in the community and sort of being now working in a global environment. This is really a slide, I think, that portrays that. In fact, when I showed Tom this slide, I remember your reaction was, I don't really understand this slide. And I'm like, well, I said, when you're working within an organization and you're coding something, if you make a mistake and it breaks, then somebody's going to come to you and say, oh, it broke, and you're going to go in and fix it. And it's a fairly mundane correction, okay? It's done privately, you go back to your desk, you type some things in, you say it's fixed, and you're like, oh, okay, fine, it's good. Okay, that's not the environment we're in. When you post a patch, in a way, your brain is now visible to the entire world, permanently. So when you've made a mistake in your code and you've posted that to the list, we're going to find it. I mean, we're good at that, right? So all of a sudden, instead of somebody coming to your cube and saying, please fix this, and you sort of sheepishly going and typing and coming back, all of a sudden you're like, oh, my God, everyone knows I'm so stupid that I just did this big mistake, right? We all make big mistakes. Believe me, I've got bruises all over the place. Perhaps I've lasted this long because I'm sort of thick enough to just keep getting hit and keep getting up again. And I take on stuff that seems insane, like Windows and Migrator and whatever other stupid things I do, but I just keep at it, right? And unfortunately, that's a new experience for a lot of people. It's humiliating for me when I make a mistake. You had said there are a bunch of times when you commit. And
I've lost count of the number of times I've committed something I thought was totally innocuous, and an hour later the build farm's all red. So,
yeah. And we get the oops commit from Tom, you know.
When Bruce discussed this slide with me, I thought, geez, right, it's something that we've been used to for years working in this project, but now that I think about it, it's something that a lot of people would not be accustomed to. If they've not had much exposure to open source practices before. But you're definitely working in public. And every mistake you make is, there for everybody to see, and you just have to accept that that's the environment that you're working in. The other way we try to explain it is be prepared to be humbled, because you will occasionally fail. But they're a little more public, in this sort of environment than maybe that they would be in some other ones, and you just have to kind of be prepared for that and accept it.
I guess this is kind of leading, because I know the answer that I would give, but do you find programming very publicly from generally programming privately. Did you find that that was somehow changed you, helped you, hurt you, was beneficial or not?
You find that to some extent you're relying on other people to spot your mistakes. So, it actually feels, now that I'm, so used to it, I feel actually more secure than if I were working in a corner somewhere. But, it probably takes time to make that mental adjustment and feel like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true for me. I mean, I remember, in fact, in talking to Tom and going over the presentation, I mean, a lot of times I'll put a patch up to get feedback from somebody. And typically, if I'm in an area of the code that I'm not familiar with, or even if I'm familiar with it and I've made another stupid mistake, which I seem to do a lot, then somebody will correct me and say, okay, this is not going to work for X, and you need to do Y. And we rely on that because, frankly, we don't understand everything about the code. But we're within a group that will give us that information where it's like a brain trust that we can go to all the time to get that, to allow us to do something that we couldn't do before. And I'll tell you, one of my sort of secret strategies is to get as far as I can and wait for somebody to come rescue me, right? So I sort of swim out and I wait for some of the rowboat to come and get me across to the other end. I will not reveal all the features I've done that with, but if I think that a feature is important, PG terminate backend, and I feel that it's not going to move forward unless I sort of run out into the burning building and wait for the fireman to come get me, I'm just going to run to the burning building, and then somebody I know will come and back me up and get that thing done. Even though they might have thought it was important, my screams for help within the burning house will eventually bring help and will eventually get me out of the building and rescued. Yeah.
But don't forget, we, especially the three of us, we have started this whole learning process that you make mistakes in public in a way smaller group that wasn't as public back then.
Yeah, people didn't care as much. Yeah, you don't have.
Invisible.
Yeah, and you don't have. Yeah, that's really true. We were sort of like tinkering in our own little sandbox, and look at these little boys play in the sand, and it's like, okay, well, you're right. It was easier then. The other thing is, I remember when I used to be in college, and I'd fail a paper or a test, and they'd kind of slip the paper to you. I don't know how you have. I'm sure some of you must have this feeling where they slip the F paper to you, and you're like, A, you get the sinking feeling, and B, you just kind of slip it in your notebook, and you're hoping nobody else sees how poorly you did. I mean, hopefully other people also did that, but I remember that, that really dejected, kind of beaten feeling, and. Sometimes I get that dejected, beaten feeling with patches, and I have to say, well, I'm doing my best, and I just keep going. But my best is not as good as a lot of you people, and I have to accept that. And frankly, your best is not as good as anybody, almost. I mean, almost as great as I can be, and I might be great in one or two things, but in everything else, everyone else blows me away, and I have to accept that. Yeah.
Is there any magic recipe for, after having run into the burning building, to attracting attention of people who weren't interested in you?
I think pathetic. Pathetic pleadings. And many of you know those, how that sounds. It usually starts out with maybe an IRC sort of plea for help with a link to something that's completely incomprehensible. Then it's going to be me calling Tom or Jan or Josh or somebody to say, I have this problem and nobody's looked at it. And then I'm going to typically shoot an email to the mailing list, and I'm going to wait a couple days for somebody to have pity on me. And then if nobody says anything, then I'm going to reply back and I'm going to say, nobody's answered me. Can somebody give me an idea? And eventually I get an idea. Like, a lot of it's IM, actually. Now that I mention it, I had a case where for PG Migrator, I didn't know what indexes changed, if gist changed between 8.3 and 8.4. So I was IMing Oleg because they weren't responding to the email. Oleg was in Nepal. As soon as Oleg came back, I saw his name appear on the IM, and I was like, boom, Oleg, okay. tell me what's going on. And he's like, Teeter's not here right now. I'll get back to you. And he did. Within 24 hours, I got the answer I needed. But a lot of it is sort of getting in people's faces and tracking them down and having a channel to get at them. I mean, I have to admit that IM is like it's like a shooting range for me sometimes, right? Because I'm like, oh, I need to talk to that person, right? And then I basically get them, and I'm pleasant enough that they don't hate me, usually. Yeah?
Did you ever try posing a blatantly stupid, horrible way of doing what you do to get someone to tell you how to do it right?
Not intentionally.
There you go. That's it. Exactly. But everyone else thought that was my strategy. Yes, that was sort of... I remember in the early days when we like wanted a feature and I'd figure out a way to do it like in the grammar, right? Or something terribly... I mean, we talked about this one, right?
Yeah, I think we're going to make that point further downstream.
That's good.
I'll just make one comment, which is Bruce has one strategy that fortunately is not too widely available, which is he can commit something that's broken. That generally gets people's attention.
That's a good one. I hadn't thought about that, yeah. There's a certain feel of fear of letting me run wild in the candy store, I guess. And they sort of hold my hand and they're like, okay, let's come over here, you know. This candy is what you want to eat.
I'm just realizing I could get a lot more features developed than I do.
Okay. Anyway.
Is this the next slide?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So. Another aspect of development that I think is sort of difficult for new people, and this goes back to the code quality issue, this goes back to having all these eyes on us, is the requirement of having to redo stuff. In most commercial organizations, it works is acceptable. I'll probably say it again. Most commercial organizations, it works means it's acceptable and we can move on. That is not our strategy, particularly because we're building the mansion, not the shack, particularly because we're working in a database, not a word processor or a game. Okay? Again, we've got a tremendous reputation that we've built up over the 13 years we've been in here, and it's going to continue that way because I know that even the new people we brought on have the same type of attitude that we've sort of been able to infiltrate down to them. This actually is a picture of Sisyphus by Titian. It is a story of a person who's condemned in hell to carry a rock up to the top of a mountain, which then falls, the rock then falls down. They then have to carry it up and over again and again forever. I know patch acceptance is not this bad, but it feels that way sometimes when you're getting into the 13th iteration of your patch and you're thinking these people are insane and why are they doing this to me? It's good enough in every other field that I work in. I do not have to carry the rock up 12 times. But in many cases, the reason our code is so good, the reason many of you are here and many of you rely on Postgres so heavily, in some ways more heavily than you would even a commercial database, is because of that sort of perfectionist, not perfectionist, but high quality requirement. And many times that requires you to carry the rock up the hill, what appears to be forever.
I don't really have anything to add on this slide, so. One thing that we find, a point that we find ourselves making over and over, is that you're working in a community, and ultimately it's going to be the community's decision whether a particular feature or patch or idea is good or not. So it's a good idea to get agreement from the community as early as you can in the process. You can save yourself a lot of going down blind alleys if you get the idea out there first and get it reviewed before you do too much work with it.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Okay.
So, okay, so what does get agreement mean, right? What does it mean when we say get agreement? A lot of times, again, this is a new kind of environment for a lot of you because I remember when I was starting with Postgres, I was like a consultant, and I worked on applications, database applications on my own for typically law firms. So I was in control of the whole process. I was in control of all the code. I did all the testing. It was a one-man shop, okay? I worked with, you know, basically people within the organization that I was consulting for, but I was pretty much controlling everything. So I ran the QA, and I ran the implementation and the design, and I worked with the client to talk about the design, but effectively I made all those decisions down the road. And a lot of you are in similar situations where you're basically making those same sort of decisions on your own, and you're only really beholden to yourself, you're beholden to your own standards, and you're beholden to the fact that the customer actually likes what you did. That's not us, okay? For you to understand that, we're going to actually break down, in the rest of the talk, we're going to break down those parts that you now need to go to the community to talk about. Because, again, going on your own and sort of developing everything on your own typically is going to lead to failure and rejection, because this is a type of organization that is trying to use the strengths of everyone within the organization, okay? Not really a single cowboy type of process. And again, I think we're stronger this way. I think we develop better code this way. But it does require some changes, particularly for people like me who started as consultants. And even people who work in organizations. I mean, typically, even if you're in a large organization, you pretty much are sort of king of your own domain, even if it's a small little domain, right? And you don't have to go through all of this approval process. So we're going to break down exactly what approvals you need and how to sort of understand them. The first approval that you really should talk about is to design the interface first. Don't start looking at the code. Don't start figuring out what C files to figure out. What do you want this thing to do that you're doing? And how is the user roughly going to interact with that? Okay? The problem is that's not the only part, but that's the first part. And you want to start there. A lot of discussions that we have about features move to implementation or move to challenges without even specifying the interface at first. And you end up sort of saying, well, if we're going to design it that way, what's the interface that's going to interact with that? And you get the discussion goes like this, around kind of in a meandering process. What we want is that we want it to be a top-down kind of process. So again, a lot of people don't work this way, but this is the way we have to work. So we want to first decide, what is your feature going to do? Not how it's going to, what it's going to do, and how is the user going to interact with that feature? That's the first step in getting community approval.
We do actually have some slides that are not pretty pictures. Here's one of them. Just to try to clarify what we're talking about here. If you're doing something that is user visible, you know, there's going to be some syntax, some semantics that you're allowed to think about early in the process and get community buy-in. There are a whole lot of smart people in this community. And if you put up, you know, an idea, usually somebody can improve on it. Frequently, by the time that discussion gets done, what you've got is something that's nothing like the idea that you started with, or, you know, at least only vaguely related to what you thought you were going to do. But, you know, once you have been through that process, you also realize that it's a lot better than your original idea. You know, it's people have helped you improve it. So the point that we're trying to make here is simply to, it's good to go through that process before you have invested a whole lot of effort on your original idea, because you may find, you know, maybe, you know, prototyping it was a good thing, or maybe you find out that you just wasted that work, so now you have to go in a different direction. So the earlier you get community buy-in on, you know, the shape of what you're going to do, the better off you're going to be.
The other thing I'd say, though, is not to try to get absolute consensus on every single detail of syntax.
You spend
forever discussing that.
Yeah, eventually you have to make a decision and move on. And it's also true that, you know, once you actually try to implement it, you may find your ideas changing more. But
So in that case, who makes the decision?
In the end, whoever is doing the work has the last say.
But
one of the things that I found frustrating on occasion is that sometimes it's very difficult to get any either encouragement or opposition until you've actually written the code. So you say, I'm interested in doing this. Does anybody think that's a good idea? And one person writes back and says, that sucks. And nobody else says anything.
Mm.
So then you go and you write it. So then you go, or one person says, that's good. And then so you go off and you write a patch and you send it in. And then everybody says, well, da 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 da. And you're like, why didn't you tell me that before I spent $6 writing this patch?
Yeah.
I mean, that sometimes does happen. People aren't paying attention for one reason or another. Something we do not have a slide on, unfortunately, but probably should have, is that you need to pay attention to what the community work cycle is. If you're sending in some brand new idea, early in the beta phase or something like that, you shouldn't be too surprised if nobody's really paying attention because they're focused on getting the current release out.
Yeah. Greg, you had questions.
I don't know. My experience is that getting the semantics, the behavior, is important. And proposing the syntax is good because it forces you to come up with a concrete suggestion. But I then basically, hopefully, if I'm not invested in a particular syntax, can back off and not care about the syntax, because there'll be lots of debate and argument about that. And as long as it's clear which features, which behaviors that we want to cover, it's worth moving ahead and letting, and when the patch finally gets submitted and gets reviewed for a committee, there will be some discussion on the precise guidelines.
Yeah.
Right. The surface level will be in
place. Yeah, the point that we are trying to make here is simply to get the community involved as soon as possible, in your development process. It's almost always better, to get some half-baked ideas out there than to be off in a corner until you think you're all done.
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to overemphasize this. There's certainly a case where you're going to have to loop back after you've implemented the patch and reevaluate the syntax. I mean, like, how many times do we get patches, and as committers, we just completely redo the syntax, right, to make it consistent. The person might not be familiar with the style that we've been using. They might not even be familiar with the facilities that we have to support certain syntaxes. So the point really is that you kind of get what a syntax to me really does is it gets people's attention. It gets attention to community members to at least give them some concrete way of understanding what you're going to do. Because until you show them a syntax and you say, this is going to do that, then a lot of times people starting at the implementation phase, the first thing we're going to tell them to do is go back and tell us what you're trying to do. And the syntax forces them to at least get some idea of what the API is going to be, and also whether there should be an API at all. A lot of times you're going to spend a lot of time playing with some syntax, and the community decision might be no syntax at all. Do it automatically. And then therefore you've eliminated the need for that. And we've had the discussion at the beginning of whether you're going to need to deal with some of the complexities of auto-tuning some of the stuff or auto-implementing some things that can happen on their own. So we're not going to really say the interface has to be in stone, but the interface to us is really your opening paragraph to what you're going to be doing.
It's hard to explain to people what you're doing without...
Exactly. Yeah, right. So, that's really what we're trying to say. Pick which one you want to do. And.
Right. That was a good point that Bruce just made, that quite a lot of what we do actually doesn't have, any external interface. If you're sitting around improving the planner's ability to make some choice or other, for example, there isn't any user interface to that. It's just that, the queries are going to work better next time. And so in that case, you might think, well, we're skipping all over this, but no, not really. There's still a designs thing in terms of this is the kind of problem I'm trying to solve, and this is what it does right now, and that's what it should do afterwards. And so you can still get a lot of useful feedback at that level of detail, even if there isn't anything that you would call user interface. The other thing I wanted to mention, to illustrate that point, is that sometimes, indeed there shouldn't be a user interface. There's a patch in the queue right now from somebody who wants to replace the GEquo heuristic optimizer with something else. And the first thing I noticed about it was the guy had 12 or 15 new GUC variables to tune the darn thing with. You know, and one of the major problems with GE Aquila now is it's got too many tuning variables that nobody knows what to do with. So, you know, he's going in completely the wrong direction there. But,
you know, the syntax often gives us a hint of what type of adjustment we need to make. Exact person approaches the more complex parts, because the easy part's the interface, right? Don't start fiddling with the back end and doing the hard part until you get the easy part done, or at least thought about. Yes?
On the subject, I think one of the questions started out as what do you do when you throw out your syntax or whatever and nobody responds? And I think maybe also the Bruce is stuck in a burning building, does someone want to help him question comes into this as well. But one way to, at least I've found, to get people to respond is to respond to somebody else. Even if it's totally unrelated to what you're doing, reviewing somebody else's patch or contributing in some obvious way to the community is a nice way to attract people to whatever your pet project is. People are more willing to listen to Bruce, for instance, because he's done a lot of stuff and people know who he is and figure that he's not going to run off and cry and never be seen again, you know, if they ignore him. I mean, he won't go away if they ignore him, I guess, is something that Bruce has proven, so... People
came out of it. I have some value some intangible value that makes them run into the building to save me.
I have to admit that there's a great deal of truth in that. If you're somebody who's, you know, done a couple things before, then you pop up and you say, I'm thinking about doing this, you have a little credibility that maybe you'll actually get it done. So people are more likely to, you know, take it seriously and think about what you're saying than if you're, you know, somebody we've never heard of before. You know, so the next question is, you know, how do you get past that first stage? And again, the answer I would give is start small, you know, do something relatively easy and uncontroversial and get it committed, you know, and now your name is known to people and, you know, they will read what you have to say. But actually the answer is it's been a custom in the project for a long time that if nobody objects to something, then there's sort of implicit approval. We are not a community where everybody feels the need to, you know, put a plus one at the bottom of something. If, you know, if we don't see anything to object to in a particular thread, we probably just won't say anything.
One or two plus ones are really helpful in having a feeling that somebody's paying attention and thinks it's okay. Who's that guy?
Right. Yeah, it's probably something that's changing over time. Feeling of it's okay if nobody objects is definitely how we were working 6 or 8 years ago, but maybe it's, you know, drifted a little bit.
Just as a thought, could we use something similar to the structure that we have for the commit fest? So, I mean, the point is that we don't want to have 50 people plus one. You know, I mean, it's clutter. But, you know, concepts or thoughts, I don't know. I mean, things that people are working on in a structured layout that more people can comment on and maybe even have some structure behind that of, you know, people asking other people to comment on it. You know what I mean?
Sometimes I'll reply and say, oh, wow, this is great. We've been waiting for somebody to do this for a long time. Or I'll point into the specific to-do item, which obviously gives them implicit approval to move forward. a lot of times what this phase does, frankly, is for us to be able to come back and say, no, you shouldn't be doing this because we already do it this way. So when somebody shows up and says, I have a new way of generating sequence numbers or a new way of, you know, generating something, we'll say, no, it's better. We already can do it this way. We don't see a value to adding to that. Again, that usually short circuits a lot of the work they have to do down the road because they've given us a nice paragraph introduction as showing us the interface. And we're like, no, the kind of standard kind of says to do it this way, or everyone's used to doing it this way. Doing it two ways is not valuable to us. And a lot of times we could just short circuit a lot of their work and move them into more productive areas. So again, that's another reason not for them to be spending too much time in implementation and to get that either plus one or tacit approval, or at least kind of confirmation from the to-do list to say, yeah, this is a direction we want to go. Most cases, when somebody shows up to do something, it's already on the to-do list. And I'll quote the to-do list to say, yeah, it's on the to-do list, meaning, yeah, go, green, go, hey, you know, we're waiting for you. So they can then go back, look at the thread of discussion, and then they have some framework of understanding what we're looking for. A lot of it is us communicating to other people, is us communicating to developers to make their job easier in getting them information so they can be productive for us, basically. Probably should go to the next slide.
Yeah.
So having gotten some type of approval for interface, again, maybe not the details, but at least the general structure, you then want to go into the mechanics. How are we going to implement the interface that we've agreed upon? Okay, so we first decided, what's it going to do for the user? That's the interface. And then how are we going to do it for the user? Like, what things are we going to do to make this thing happen? And this is the second area that actually is quite complicated for people. And you have to often help them to get to this stage. Most patches who go through the interface and the implementation discussions end up successful. Where we lose people is where they start fighting with us on how to implement it, or they don't agree with whatever syntax we're trying to tell them we need to follow, and they sometimes leave because they're not willing to work within a global community. They're not willing to get correction from other people. They're not willing to get help from other people in some ways. They're too proud to get help, or they think they know everything. I don't know sometimes why. I don't think it's anybody in this room, but again, there are people who just don't want to work in a collaborative environment, and in some ways, we can't help them. But the cool thing is the people we can help and the people who have been successful, we can help them a lot. We can take them from, you know, walking to running. And one of the reasons I got involved in this community so many years ago is that they took me from a sort of pretty good programmer to a sort of pretty good programmer, right? I mean, a little better programmer. But again, I was willing to take that correction and take the direction and learn from other people who knew more than I do and had more brain power than I do.
Anyway, the things you need to think about at this level are, where are you going to make this patch? What parts of the system are going to be affected? How does it interface with what's already there? The example that came up when we were discussing this part of the talk was back at the beginning, late 90s or so, one of the few parts of the system that we really understood thoroughly was the parser grammar, gram.y. And you will find that there's a lot of stuff that we did in gram.y that shouldn't have been there, but that was the part that we knew how to patch. So
that was me sometimes.
Yeah, I think we all did it. There are still things that are in there, in fact, that, you know, we haven't gotten around to cleaning up. The one that bothers me every time I look at it is the way that some of the built-in functions like current timestamp and now are implemented. Those right in the grammar, there's a little expansion of that into an equivalent expression, and that's the wrong way to do it because that makes that implementation visible again when somebody looks at a rule or a view or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, what comes out is the expanded thing and not the original function call. So it's definitely the wrong thing to do. You know, we shouldn't have done it that way. We haven't gotten around to cleaning it up, but you know, now we know a lot more about the structure of the system, and we have a better idea of where things ought to plug in. So, you know, one of the important things and one of the things that, you know, will cause a patch to fail is to be doing the wrong thing in the wrong place. There, you know, it's either it's a lot easier to do it in the right place, or there is some aspect like how will it behave in a view listing that you have to think about, and then in order to do it right, you have to do it in a particular place to make that behavior still work. There's not too much else to say about this. We just wanted to point out that a couple of things people commonly forget are PG dump support. You know, if you're doing anything that involves catalog entries or the behavior of views or whatever, it's very likely that that's going to affect PG dump somehow, and you have to remember to include that in your patch. You know, maybe not in the first draft, but it better be there before it's going to get committed. I think we need to move a little faster.
Yeah, we're looking at 45, so we have 15 minutes.
Yeah. Formatting matters. If your patch looks like this, we're probably not even going to review it. I wouldn't actually say that anybody submitted anything that looked quite that bad, but it does matter. We do have some standards about these sorts of things. Tabs are four spaces, not some other number. We like BSD brace style. Some of these things you can get wrong, and we won't correct you because we know that PG Indent will fix it. But PG Indent is not perfect. It is, for instance, one thing I've noticed is it's a lot brighter about horizontal adjustments and vertical adjustments. It will not do too much about removing a wacko number of blank lines you've left in the middle of routine, for instance. So you need to pay some attention to what the code looks like and try to make it readable to whoever is reviewing it. And one of the best ways you can do that is to follow the style of the immediately adjacent code in whatever you're patching. It just looks better that way, and it will help you do the right thing. Do you have anything to add here?
You're great.
Okay, I'll let you do this one.
Okay. Back to the shack idea, that naming indeed is important. It does help future developers that may be around after you've retired to continue working on the code. Just to highlight this example, what color is this? Everybody?
Red.
Red. What color is this?
Orange.
All right, exactly. What color is that? Right, yeah. So you kind of have your eyes telling you one thing and your brain telling you something else. Obviously, we don't have people doing this, although I will give you a good example. I was just over the Starbucks, and what is the name of Starbucks small coffee?
Tall.
What's medium?
Grande.
And tall and large? Venti, right. So tall is small and grand is medium. We're close here, okay? Right next door, if you don't believe me, okay? And I was thinking this is exactly that problem. And in fact, there's a comedy skit where the guy comes up and gets so confused because they're like, well, the small is tall. Again, we don't have people doing this very much, but we're really here to highlight some of the aspects of naming and to say that, yeah, it is important. And we're going to go into even more detail about naming and commenting as we get into the slides. But again, we're building the mansion. We're not building the shack. If we kind of come to you and say, variable I is really not a great name for this loop variable, are we being a pain? Yeah. Do we have larger goals in mind than being a pain? Yes. We are not doing it to be a pain. We're doing it because we have a stewardship of this code that I think everybody, when we started, had a feeling of stewardship for the people at Berkeley who wrote it, some very smart people, and we want to continue that. And some of that is actually having to care about things that you might not have to care about in your normal job, and that is things like naming.
Right. We do have naming conventions. We have multiple naming conventions. Depending on what part of the code you're looking at, you may find...
Oh, thank you.
There it is. You can find some of this. That's okay. There are other parts, do more like that. That's okay, too. It is good to do the same thing as what's already being done in the part of the code that you're working on just because, it looks better that way. There's also some of this, run on words without any separation, but most of the time that's probably better to avoid. I think actually the only place that's fairly common practice is field names, where we tend to have a prefix that's related to the table name just to help you remember which table that field comes from.
Personally, I'd rather we didn't do it with field names either.
Yeah, but it's an established convention, and we're not going to change it at this point. One of the things I've still am annoyed at after 10 years is that there is one column in PG database where we didn't have the prefix. You know, it's I think it's encoding. You know, it should be data encoding, but we're not going to change it now because it would break, you know, who knows what in the user side code. But it was, you know, it was wrong to begin with, and it's still wrong. Practically, the only thing I would say we don't do is we do not do any Hungarian notation. That's, you know, it's not the style. Don't try to make it the style because you're not going to succeed. The way I like to explain this point is once your patch has gone in, it should look like it had been there all along. People frequently will send us patches where, you know, there are comments or ifdefs or whatever there put in solely to make the patch stand out from what's around it. And maybe that was helpful to them while they're developing it, but we're not going to commit it that way. Practically all of the major parts of the code, at this point, those files have had hundreds of commits to them over the life of the project. You know, and if each of those patches had been designed to stand out, you would have an ugly, unreadable mess on your hands. So, you know, don't do what this bricklayer did. And to be specific about it, these are all things I've actually seen, you know, in submitted patches within the last year or so. Pay attention to the code that you're patching and, you know, do whatever is being done in the immediate vicinity, even if, you know, elsewhere in your patch you're patching some other file where, you know, the style's a little different. You got to match that too, you know. That's the way it is. It's a large code base, and it is not uniform by any means because different parts were written at different times. But try to blend in. You know, comments are not there to mark off your code from everybody else's code. They're there to help the reader understand. And by and large, we don't sign our individual contributions in the source code. Once in a long while, you'll find a comment that's signed because, you know, somebody was saying, I'm not too sure about this, but maybe I'm not very bright about it. But, you know, we don't put in our names just to say, I wrote this piece of code.
Great.
Anything you want to add there?
Beautiful.
Okay, you can take this one.
Okay. I alluded to this already. The issue of commenting, again, some people who work in the shack environment don't need comments. They remember what they're doing. They're the only people who are going to be looking at it in 5 years from now, or they don't care who's going to be looking at it from 5 years from now, which is unfortunately sometimes more the case. I think the Postgres code is actually really good style-wise, design-wise, and understanding appearance-wise. I remember when I started with Postgres, those of you know me, I'm a pretty good programmer, but compared to the global pool of talent that we have, I'm not that great. So I started to say, okay, what can I do to help the project? And it wasn't programming. Like if I'm a good programmer and I program like 8 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours a day, I've done one 12-hour day, okay? But if I can make the code easier for 10 other people to code, then I can get 10 things done in one day by enabling those 10 people. So the reason PG and DEN exists, the reason that I used to go through and with the BSD code just make these huge commits in the 90s to just kind of clean stuff up, to rename whole subsections and variables and structures to try and get some sanity to this thing, is because one of my goals was to make it easier for you as a group to enhance Postgres. Frankly, I haven't done that in the last like 5 years because I'm done in many ways. But we need to continue in that vein. That has to do with naming. That has to do with the stuff Tom was talking about, having your code fit in, you know, design and so forth. But one aspect of that that's fairly important is comments. I know some of you just don't feel comments are important, at least in your professional lives. As community members, as people who are developing code that has lasted for 20 years and will last for another 20, we do consider important. If we look at this particular block of code here, this is actually from keywords.c. I can kind of see, there's a for loop. And, we're comparing some alpha here. And then I'm calling some functions. And then I've got some difference calculations with a middle something. And that's exactly what I'm thinking when I'm looking at that code. That's how I'm kind of thinking of it. However, fortunately, this is not what's in our code. What's in our code is this. And what's in our code now very clearly explains what this does right here and very clearly explains what this does down here. So all of a sudden, by spending the time as a programmer to write 1, 2, 3 sentences, I've made it easier for many, many people down the road to understand my code. And often when I'm in a particular module and I don't really know what's going on, I can just read the comments. And at the top of each section within that function, and I can understand what that function does. And I can understand, I probably don't care about that function. I care about something that function calls. And as I'm walking through that code, I can say, here's where we call read buffer. That's where I want to go. Or here's where we're going to validate the visibility for that. And then there's a comment at the top. And I'm like, that's where I want to go. Okay? It's tremendously amazing how good some of the stuff is. I had to do a source code internals class last week. And I've been doing it for the past couple weeks for Enterprise DB folks. And I'm in areas of the code that I'm not typically in. And I'm having to walk through the executor to show them how we read a buffer in. And all of a sudden, I'm in the executor. I'm looking at some code. I'm not quite sure where I want to go because I'm not familiar. But as I read the comments above each group of block, I now can understand exactly where I need to go to get to the part that I'm interested in. And again, this is a question of using a little bit of your time to multiplicatively enable people down the road to make things better and to make their job easier.
It's also to enable yourself.
Yeah. Think about yourself 2 years from now.
And his own code 5 years down the road.
Yeah.
Fix something in there.
That's right.
Maybe does not know the real value of comments.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We picked out this particular example because I think it is a very good example of the kind of commenting style we like. You could have a comment for practically every line in this routine, but I don't think that would make it more readable. What's been done here is, first off, this comment is explaining something that, if you look at this and you realize it's downcasing the text, the first thing you might wonder is, boy, that's dumb. Why didn't they use 2 lower? So the comment is explaining exactly why we didn't use 2 lower, so that somebody won't be tempted to break it, by improving it somewhere down the road. This one is basically just a signpost. We assume you've heard of binary search before, and if you haven't, you can certainly Google it. But, that's enough to get you started on figuring out exactly what and why this chunk of code is doing it. We're not going to, give you a blow-by-blow account of how binary search works, but we want you to know that that's what you're looking at. And, as Bruce was saying, maybe that's not what you care about. In that case, you can, skip right to the next step. This is an example of, a case where there is 3 times as much comment as there is code.
I think it's 10.
Not really. I mean, we didn't have room on the slide to show you the whole routine that's attached to this. So really, it's
a little bigger. Okay.
I think it's about 20 lines of comment to about 20 or 30 lines of actual code. And the reason, again, is that this is explaining some details that you would not in 100 years get from just reading the code. The code is straightforward in what it does. If you look at it, it's making this particular transformation. But what is extremely not obvious is that transformation has to happen in a particular order relative to some other transformations that are done elsewhere. And so what the comment is telling you about, again, it's to protect somebody from breaking it because they didn't really quite understand how it works. So,
but there are counterexamples in the code,
There are places that are idiotic.
Long, you haven't understood it.
Yeah. 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 All that scene. That's right. I was telling somebody yesterday about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that one I think is actually left over for Berkeley days. Yeah. Someday we ought to improve it.
So just FYI, you guys are officially in overtime now.
Yeah, yeah. We need to move a little faster. We can actually skip over this thing pretty quickly. I think it's just some specifics. This is the way to deal to protect a comment block if you don't want PG indent reflowing the text on you, which it will otherwise tend to do. A lot of times, if it's running text, you don't care. It's just as fine. But if you're doing something that involves formatting an example or something like that, you want to make sure the PG indent won't break it for you. You want to say anything quick about this?
Just that testing's important. You want to test without passengers. A lot of people don't feel sometimes tests are valuable, but because we have a high reliability standard, we are going to often want some kind of testing to go on before it gets to us. We're going to test it longer. We don't rely just on tests. I know there's some people who just do like unit tests for everything. We find it's actually better to read the code to look for failures than to try and test for them. So I'm not saying that testing is the be-all and end-all, but it's certainly something that you want to anticipate when you're developing your patch.
Right. These are the sorts of things you ought to think about when you're thinking about how to test your patch. How does it relate to the existing regression tests? Do you need to add some new ones? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. It's easy to go overboard on having too many regression tests because one of the important properties of the regression tests is that they don't take so long and people are discouraged from running them. So I think actually, I tend to remove tests rather more often than add them, really, when I commit a patch. But, it's important to think about whether you need them and have an appropriate number. And non-portable constructs are another constant thorn in the side. We will find them at the latest when the build farm gets hold of it, but, it can be embarrassing to make the build farm go all red because you didn't think about that. And documentation. That's... you can take this one.
I don't have much to say either. We've come to a case where documentation is part of the patch. If you're not a native English speaker, we'll handle it. We'll rewrite your whole documentation chapter if we have to. Just give us something, right? And we'll clean it up and make sure that it matches the surrounding code. Some things you need to look at in terms of documentation. Are there manual pages that need to be updated for your new area? Are there administrative changes that we now need to document? Do you need to document a new function? Or where does it go? If you're not sure where it goes, ask us. We'll give you some ideas because we're probably more familiar with the code than you are. Typically, if it's lacking documentation, we'll get a complaint during beta and say, this new feature, I really don't see where it's documented. It looks like this part of the manual is now invalidated because of this new behavior, for example. We changed the way vacuum works. All of a sudden, that changes a lot of assumptions that we've made in the docs. And we're pretty good at, kind of cleaning it up. But, again, just keep in mind that that's something you need to, a checkbox you need to look at.
Okay. So we do actually finally get to the conclusion. The example that we wanted to give is the amount of time that it took Thomas Edison to develop the electric light bulb. It took him years and thousands of experiments. The concept was perfectly clear, but finding a material that would last long enough to be commercially sensible as a light bulb just took him an awful lot of perseverance. And you've heard certainly the famous quote about 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. Getting a patch submitted is frequently about like that. One good idea, and many, many hours later, you've actually got a complete patch.
Yeah, I thought what really struck me about this was A, the second part, which you're familiar with. Genius is 1% inspiration and 90% perspiration. But what the part you might not have seen is the part that we feel as we develop patches. And that is, the electric light bulb has caused me the greatest amount of... I'll put my glasses on. All right, I got it. The greatest amount of study, and has required me the most prior, the most elaborate experiments, Thomas Edison wrote. I was never myself discouraged or inclined to be hopeless of success. I cannot say the same for all my associates. So what this really tells me is that Edison feels what we feel, that when you embark on bringing a patch to Postgres, it feels like perhaps the greatest amount of study and the most elaborate experiments you've ever had to do. But fortunately for Edison, he never despaired, he never gave up, and he kept going, and he succeeded. And in many ways, developing patches for Postgres require the same amount of perseverance. I'd love to say that developing patches for Postgres is always fun, always in a sort of self-esteem enhancing experience, but it's often the opposite. It's often some of the hardest work you've ever done, and it's some of the most frustrating work you've ever done. But through frustration and hard work comes growth, and I think that's one of the great things, great rewards we can give to people who do work with Postgres, who do submit patches, and who are successful in that process.
That's it for me.
Thank you.
We do still have 20 minutes before the next talk, so I guess there's a little room for questions if anybody has any more. Okay.
There does seem to be kind of a gray area between feedback people get.